Hello, I'm Heather Barnes, food and product photographer and storyteller behind the lens. Our Austin-based team is all about visual solutions. For your brand, it's essential for your product to be memorable and have stickiness. Our clients like Ghirardelli, Tiff's Treats, and Nautamu choose our photography to develop positive associations with their brand. They call our work inspiring because it moves consumers into a relationship with their company. And we can do the same for you. Learn more today at heatherbarnes.com. Focused on you, your story, and your success with memorable photography garnished with love.
And welcome back to Success Made to Last Legends. I'm Rick Tokini. This show is brought to you by Edward Jones Financial Advisors, along with Heather Barnes Media and Thermo Joe. Our special guest today on Legends is Ramon Hervey II, author of The Fame Game, an insider's playbook for earning your 15 minutes. Ramon is, a colorful character, pioneer in the toughest side of the entertainment business, the demanding work and genius of conceptualizing, molding, sustaining, and fixing the messes of celebrities. If that's not enough to hook you into buying this book, I don't know what will be, other than this conversation we're going to have. Welcome to Legends, Ramon.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it. Nice to be invited to be on your show.
You bet. You know what we do on the Legends show?
I have some sense of what it is, yes.
We honor people that we think have moved from success to significance. And typically they've written a book about their crazy career. And from that book come all sorts of lessons for the next generation. Do you think that your book is a book of life lessons?
That's a very interesting question. Yeah, I think it's my life, and I took the liberty of sharing some of my experiences with many famous people that I had a chance to build confidence and trust in, and so I'm sharing some of their lives as well. And the lessons, I think, are really about my philosophical approach to fame and the difference between fame and success. So I don't think that fame is a destination. It's an accolade. It's an honor that you get as a byproduct of success. And the lesson I hope people realize is that if you focus on being the best that you can be, rather than being obsessed with fame, and you strive to be successful, you're going to attain more satisfaction, and it'll be more sustainable than trying to become famous.
Wow. Words of wisdom. That's what we thought we were going to get. You are as advertised. That's great. Why did you choose this time of your life to write a book? And kind of in retrospect, would you have even been ready 5 or 10 years ago?
You know, everyone seems to want to know that, the answer to that question. I don't know if I've ever figured that out myself yet. But what happened was I've been encouraged to write a book for quite some time, and I thought I was too young or too still fervently involved with my career that I didn't want to write a memoir. Mm-hmm. And that's still the case. This book is not a memoir. It's really a retrospective, so I'm glad you used that term, of my career. And I found that looking back on my career, what's made it unique is my relationships and the people that I've worked with in the roles of being a manager and a publicist. And as a role in the entertainment business, both of those roles are different, but they're somewhat similar in the fact that people come to me with a vision, an artistic vision, that they want to try to achieve commercial success. And they're looking for my strategy and my insight, my guidance to try to help them accomplish that. And I thought that was noteworthy because I've been very fortunate to work with some very iconic talents. And I thought, well, maybe if I can share my insight and put people in a seat next to me, sort of let them feel in real time what it's like to be on the roller coaster that I've been on, trying to manage and help, you know, shine a light on these people and their lives and help them to be more successful and reach that balance between their art form, whatever that might be, whether it's music, television, movies, sports. I've worked with all people in all those veins. And then to try to find a way for them to achieve commercial viability. And I think when you merge those two and you create a marriage of that, and there's a great work ethic, again, I think you can achieve success. And so my book really tells those tales, and just the fact that there is no one way to do it. If there was, I think that's what I would really be selling, not this book. I would be selling my magical potion of how to be successful and famous. And there isn't one, because everyone that I've ever worked with took a different path. And in the book, I try to highlight that and show that there is not any one way to become successful in our business.
That's right. Okay, we have now gone 5.5 minutes without mentioning a particular star that you've represented or helped or rescued. And so that is mission accomplished by our team, because this is supposed to celebrate Ramon Hervey and your book, The Fame Game. But let's face it, the work that you've done is historic, legendary, and you have literally rescued some people. So let's get down into the weeds now. After reading this, I had two big questions. And so, and at any given time, Ramon, you can go, move along, Ricky. I don't want to answer that one. But I recall.
I'm an open book for you, Rick.
Well, I appreciate that. I appreciate that. Let's start with this one. You knew and worked with Richard Pryor, one of the greatest comedians of our lifetime. And Richard was on what a lot of people would call a destructive path of his own. I want you just to tell our listening audience about how you guided that process. And you may not have to go too far into detail, but how did you lead that whole process to allow Richard Pryor to possibly go down the right avenue?
First of all, I don't think I led him to go down any avenue, to be honest. I helped. I was given an assignment, you know, when I first got an opportunity to represent Richard. I was contacted by his manager at the time, David Franklin. And he told me that they wanted me to represent, you know, Richard. And I was, you know, I was a huge fan of his before I even got a chance to work with him. And, you know, the potential lights, you know, went off in my head of all the things I thought I could do with Richard, because he was iconic. He had already, you know, he was very successful at the time that I, you know, in the mid 70s when I started working with him. So it wasn't like I made him a star. He was already a star. And my impression was that he wanted to move the needle a little bit more. And that's why I was brought in. I worked at a company called Rogers and Cowan, which was one of the most successful PR, entertainment PR companies in the business at that time. They were also the very first one to do independent public relations, when the studios used to do all that for all the stars, and they were the first ones to start that. So I was very lucky to even be at that place at that time, to be in a position to be considered as one of the only black, I was the only black executive at that company. And these guys found me and said, we want you to represent us. So those two things were very unique. What I learned with Richard was that I think he wanted a protector of his image more than he wanted someone to help fuel it. He didn't really, he never asked me to try to make him more famous. He never asked me to get one interview for him. you know, he mostly, I was like, I can't, you know, he canceled a lot of stuff and he wanted me to clean up the mess of canceling it. I mean, that's really what I did more than anything else. But I'll tell you what I do think was a thing that I contributed to the most was I was responsible for, and I think this is a lesson too, is sometimes the greatest ideas are not your own, but you need to know when you come across a great idea and what to do with it. And so I was approached by a guy named Bill Sargent, who was an impresario producer who became famous because he offered the Beatles $50 million for a reunion. And he told me that he wanted to do a live concert, comedy concert with Richard Pryor. And at that time, nobody was doing that. I mean, the only one like in an arena sized theater. So it was a new form of art form that nobody had done yet. Lenny Bruce had done something at a club, you know, in New York, I believe it was, but it was in a very small club and this was going to be a big arena concert. And I talked to David about it, his manager, and he said, yeah, if you can put this together, I think I can try to get Richard to do it. So I helped to, you know, broker the relationship between Bill Sargent and Richard and his manager. We did it, and it was called Richard Pryor Live in Concert. And we did it at Long Beach Auditorium. And it was the first one of several that he did. And one of the things that Richard, so that was really a cornerstone of his, the way that he marketed himself. Part of his brilliance and genius was that he was very vulnerable as a performer. And he shared all of his missteps. And he put them in a way in which people could laugh at them. And he integrated all of these things in his live performances. And that one live concert film, he did about four of those, all the way to the end where the one where he, you know, the last one that he did, I think, was the one that where he, you know, tried to commit suicide and he was, you know, almost blew himself up. And he used that in the comedy. And I always, you know, in terms of crisis management, the key is how do we move away from it? It's not really, I'm not really a spin doctor, but it's how do we move away from it? Richard embraced and confronted all of his demons in comic by using comedy to do it. In the Richard Pryor Live in Concert film, he had just been, he didn't get arrested, but the police came to his home. He had shot all the four tires out of a Mercedes that his wife was trying to leave her place. And in his first show, he said, yeah, my wife was trying to leave. And I said, not in this car you want. And he shot all four tires so she couldn't leave the house. And he put that in his first. And in fact, at that concert, she had served him. She had a guy that was looking around in the auditorium and had planned on serving Richard with papers for the divorce. And we found out about it and we had an after party planned and everything. We had to cancel it so that he could get out of there and not get served. So all that was going on in the back, you know, and that's the kind of things that Richard did. I mean, he canceled, he was supposed to run in a 40-yard dash as a celebrity for Muhammad Ali Invitational track meet that he created. And, you know, I was at his house and he told me he wasn't in good enough shape to do it. And he called me in his own house to tell me after I'd seen him and told him we're running late, go down, you know, and he said, I'm going to go downstairs. I'm going to take a shower and then we'll leave. And he had been up there with some of his cronies. And I was up there sitting in his den by myself. The phone rang several times. I figured he was in the shower. So I answered, you know, the Pryor residence, and it was Richard Pryor calling me in his own house because he didn't want to come back upstairs to tell me that, you know, he wasn't in good enough shape to go. And he wanted me to go down and tell Muhammad Ali in person, you know, basically to lie to him, to tell him, you know, he had a stomach flu or what. I think that's what we use as an excuse for why he wasn't able to make the track meet. But he was a brilliant, brilliant man. He was self-destructive. But I learned a lot of lessons from him in terms of how to deal with crises and, you know, how you have to understand that each client has a different path that they're on. And sometimes you can't intervene or change that. You know, there were things that I couldn't do. I couldn't alter the way, the path that Richard was on. And you just try to do the best that you can to make the most out of that relationship.
It's fascinating. And you've said a couple of times now, there is not a cookie cutter approach. Everybody is different. It's almost like you, Ramon, you have to forget about the past and all of your other experience because what's in front of you needs to be dealt with.
Yeah, I think that's really a good point. Everything that I've done, I think, and it's really much harder to do today because, you know, with social media and everything, there's a visceral reaction. And so once mm-hmm. opinions are formed, this whole idea that you can spin it's not realistic. You know, and when I started in the business, there was really no social media. There were newspapers, television, whatever. But the cycle of a news story, it emanated and it developed much differently than it does today. So, you know, what's happening with a Kanye West or Will Smith, when you go on major on the biggest television show in the world from the U.S. and you do something that everyone can see simultaneously within a matter of seconds, they've already formed their opinion. And so mm-hmm. you know, people like me as a manager or a publicist, it's very hard to reshape or to explain to people what they saw was not true or the reason why it happened. All those things become much harder to really control and manipulate the story in any way or shape at all. So my goal always was to understand the collateral damage, but to come up with, decisions that would help people move away from whatever, if it's self-inflicted or whatever. How do we, create a way for people to move past their mistakes? That's really simply put. Because people are going to make mistakes. Everyone makes errors. Some of them are more critical. Some break laws. And it just depends on what the situation is as to how much we as a manager or my peers, how much we really can make an impact and change the outcome.
Wow. That is so insightful. Okay. He is Ramon Hervey II. His book is The Fame Game, an insider's playbook for earning your minutes. Where can our listeners get that book?
Hopefully everywhere. It's available digitally on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, every major, online book distribution. It's available in local bookstores. However you consume your literary world, it's available. You can get it in hardback. It's available in audio and also as an ebook.
Very good. And we will be right back with our special guest, legendary Ramon Hervey, after this quick word from our sponsor.
Hi, everybody. This is Cliff Rose. I'm one of the inventors of the Thermojoe temperature-controlled heating coffee mug. I'm calling from beautiful downtown Fairfield, Iowa. And I'm sitting here enjoying a perfect cup of coffee with the new Thermojoe heating coffee mug. The Thermojoe solves the age-old problem of your coffee getting cold fast, like before the end of a phone call. And if you're a tea drinker, we have you covered as well with our custom tea infuser. Check it all out at thermojoe.com and use promo code SUCCESS1 and get a 30% discount. That's a really good deal. Just visit us at thermojoe.com. That's thermojoe.com.
And we're back with Ramon, and wow, I wish I could do a podcast series with you, because now we're going deep into life lessons. And you've, with this last question that you answered, you said moving past mistakes. I've got to ask you, throughout your career, take this moment as a thank you moment to thank those that taught you how to problem solve and how to tell authentic stories that people will trust.
I think there's a lot of people I do thank in the book, because it's, at different times, as you're going through your journey, different people impact you in a different way based on your experience that you have developed on your own. So my mm-hmm. approach was always to be a sponge and try to read the room. And it's not so much what you say, It's what you hear. And I think listening for me is the biggest part of being able to be around people that if I just listen to what they're telling me or what they're showing me, I can dissect that and learn from those lessons. And it's not, you know, it's not hanging out with them or, you know, having drinks or whatever. Like, you know, I got a chance to work with Stevie Wonder and to see how a young Black kid like him built the leverage that he had at Motown back in the day. You know, I worked with him on his biggest record of his career, I think, you know, in my own opinion, Songs in the Key of Life. And here's a young man who's in his 20s at that time who called a marketing meeting at Motown and said he wanted to speak to everybody, all the major division heads at the company, to see what they were going to do to promote Songs in the Key of Life. And he started off the meeting, I'll never forget this. He said, well, I'm glad that you guys are all here. And I want to tell you, on my agenda, the first thing that's really important to me is I want to have a billboard in Times Square that's so big and so bright that even I can see it. And that's how we started off the meeting, you know, with that kind of enthusiasm and sense of humor. But he was dead serious about what he knew that he had something mm-hmm. special, and he really wanted to know what the label was going to do. So being in a place like that, for me, I mean, I was thrilled, and I've never forgot. I've known Stevie now for a long time, and I've mentioned him several times. You know, do you remember how we met? And I quoted him, and he goes, yeah, Ramon, I know, I remember saying that, you know. But those are the experiences that I cherish, you know, when you say, like, you know, learning, you know, from some of the most critical, some of these iconic, Bette Midler was another person that, you know, being in the room and seeing how famous people treat their fame or successful people, because I don't recall ever talking to one client about being famous. Not one. I mean, I've worked with the, you know, I got a chance to talk to Marvin Gaye for an hour once. I remember about an album that he did, Hear My Dear. We've never once mentioned the word fame. Bette Midler, who's had a career that's spanned over 50 years, and she's one of the most influential people in my career, because she joined my company when I went independent, when she could have hired any publicist in the business. I met her at Rogers and Cowan, and I worked with her there, and then I went out on my own. And she didn't come with me right away, but she came to me at a time when she was at the top of her, you know, apex of her career, and she said, I want to work with you. And that really helped to move the needle in my career. It reinforced my position and my stature in the business. So she's been, and we had a really a great collaborative relationship I had with her, where she gave me access to her. And again, it's not so much a personal thing. It's what you learn from their experiences and what you take away from those that help you to understand the best way that you can be productive on their behalf. So she was very, very instrumental. Richard Pryor was very instrumental. I got a chance to work a little bit with Muhammad Ali, and just being in his presence. He's one of my favorite people in life. He was really instrumental. And then my ex-wife, too, Vanessa Williams. I got an opportunity to work on, you know, I met her with given a task of, what do you do when a crisis surfaces and you have 72 hours to figure out how to deal with it? That's where I met Vanessa. And fortunately, by the time I was given that challenge, I was a seasoned professional, and I had a strategy and plan. But I had to work and collaborate with lawyers, her family, her, to try to come up with a response to what the pageant then. Everybody kind of knows her story, so I don't want to go through all that. But, you know, she was faced with a request to resign because some pictures surfaced of her. And the question was, and they gave her 72 hours to respond to that. They didn't force her to resign. They asked her to resign. And then my job was, how do we do that? And when I first got involved, I didn't even know what her decision was going to be. It took a weekend. And when I arrived in New York to meet her for the first time, there was an encampment of over 450 media people outside of her home. You know, I took a red eye from LA to New York, and my 72 hours started from, you know, creating a press conference on Friday afternoon that would happen on Monday morning at the very end of that 72 hours. So that was a really great experience. We went on to get married and have a life, raise three kids. So I would have to put her in that basket of, you know, people have who have influenced my life.
Thank you for that. Your legendary career in life, I think, is all about you being trusted, and then you figured out how to have smart collaborations. And isn't it great to have a career and a life that's defined by figuring out how to work with people, and not to make them famous necessarily, but to make them significant?
Yeah, I kind of look at my career as, you know, you kind of were put in this position of creating illusions. That's what our business is about, putting people on a pedestal that really doesn't exist in real life, but it does for the purposes of, you know, the entertainment business. But, you know, entertainers are no different than the rest of us. You know, they have life struggles like all of us do. And I think where my, you know, just trying to be a voice of reason, and to understand that, you know, to try to get people to feel comfortable with entrusting me with their careers and helping them to make decisions. Because it's never, I never believed that with any of my clients that it was, quote unquote, our career. It was always their career. I'm just here to help you. I'm not here to, you know, and if I didn't agree with something, I let them know. If I agree with something, I let them know. Just so that they understood that, you know, I'm not attached to your success. And I don't benefit as much from it as you will ever. So I'm only here to help be a voice of reason, give you reasons why you may not want to do this or maybe why you should do it, and know that we just want to win. We either all win or we all lose. And I think my calmness and my ability to assess and understand each situation and each client that they allowed me in their lives in a way in which I knew them well enough to where I could psychologically give them, understand the best way to approach them, when to approach them, when to help them make decisions, because that you're somewhat of a psychologist in that sense, but it's more just like anything, you know, like even with your wife, whatever, when's the best time to talk to her? Well, when at 6 a.m. when she's trying to get the kids ready for school, that's not the best time. So you have to figure out all those little details. When will my energy be best used? You know, when are my resources, my knowledge and expertise be most valuable? And knowing the time of day, what's going on in their life at that particular time, all those little things, I think, play a role in gaining people's trust, because they feel like you have a sense of who they are and what they're going through.
Man, oh man, you were stealing words right out of my mouth, but here's a question for you, see if I can shape it properly. Based on what you just said, you've had multiple marriages within your lifetime, and beyond the marriage to Vanessa, you're married to a client because you've got to figure out what time of the day to address them, right?
Yeah.
So if you were to take this is the beginning of our lightning round, take 5 individuals that you've been metaphorically married to because you took care of them. Who's
name,
at the
name 5 individuals?
Yeah, 5 individuals, and you've already mentioned Stevie Wonder, and you've already mentioned, what could the Bee Gees be one of those that you had to be married to help rescue?
I think the Bee Gees, we were just dating. I didn't know them well enough to be considered married to them, but okay. I did deal with a big issue in their life. I would say Rick James. I spent 6 years working with him. Definitely Andre Crouch, a gospel singer by the name of Andre Crouch, 9-time Grammy Award winner. I actually worked with him for over 20 years. Bette Midler, definitely.
Yep.
That's 3. Quincy Jones. Not because I represented him for a lengthy time, but he was a mentor to me, and he helped me out in many different ways as a friend. So he's someone that I really look up to and really value immensely. He's been a great influence on my life. That's four. God, there's so many other people. I worked with a George Benson, I would put in there maybe.
Oh, my goodness.
George Benson. I worked with him in a very crucial time in his career where he actually became crossed over into pop and was able to expand his horizons and not just be considered one of the best jazz guitarists of all time, but he really got an opportunity to explore his artistry in a way that he had not had a chance to do. So I think that he, watching that happen for him was really enlightening to see the difference in what he was able to accomplish once more people were able to have access to his virtuoso, you know, talents.
Mm. Very good. All right. Next question is, you've had such clarity in your brain and you've had to work fast and you've been on the clock in many cases to solve problems. Where does your clarity come from?
I think it's my thought process and also researching. You know, I've been I study this industry. So I don't do things just from the seat of my pants. And I follow my peers. This has gone all the way back to the very beginning, and just to try to see what are other people doing in critical situations. And then I assess that and I learn from those experiences, even though I wasn't involved with them, and watch and then put myself in the shoes of what I would have done had I been given an opportunity to do it. So just really trying to understand the business, not just from my own personal experiences, but just from, you know, the knowledge that you gain from watching someone else, particularly when you're at a point in your own career where you can assess, critically assess whether those decisions that were made were correct or wrong. And then what would you do if you were given the opportunity to be in those shoes? So I think just having a really great understanding of my business and how it works.
Mm, beautiful. Every legend we've ever had on teaches lessons. What do you think, if we had your kids on today, what would they say is the greatest life lesson that Dad has taught them?
Oh, my kids? concentrate and focus. I started that with them when they were little kids. It was the last thing that I would ask them to tell me when I dropped them off at school. And I would ask them, what are you guys going to do today? And it became a life lesson for them. Concentrate and focus. That's your job. You go to school. I'm a parent. Your job is to be a student. And you can't be a good student unless you concentrate and focus. So go in that school and just do your job, concentrate and focus. And you'll learn something from that. So I think they would all share that. And to understand, you know, to do your research, understand how to, you know, how to win, how to be smart.
Mm. Wow. I absolutely love that and admire it and respect it. Just a couple more questions for you. We always want to know about individuals that seem to find themselves in the right place at the right time. Is there some kind of formula or luck or God's blessing, or what has it been about you that you've been at the right place at the right time?
Earnestly, I think it's just hard work. I think you just have to continue to strive and do your best and hope that when the opportunities you're given, you're able to perform at the highest level possible. And I think as long as you're on that, you know, that sort of pace and that path of always making the most of each opportunity, it could potentially open a door. So don't underestimate the doors, how they get open. And you usually open a door through hard work and through doing things that people ask of you. It's what you're able to think out of the box and add beyond what they ask of you. So I think that's really, really been important to me, is I'm not thinking about what they're asking. I'm thinking, what can I do to push the needle further for myself? What can I do to show that I have more to offer than what they think I have to offer? And I think that comes from taking risk and being able to accept and learn from your failures, because everyone fails in life. And we don't test ourselves from being successful. We test ourselves and challenge ourselves from our failures. And the sooner that you understand that, then the better, you know, you're able to, again, open, bring more opportunity into your life and into your experiences.
You got it. You are a legend. And The Fame Game is a book about life lessons. And you can learn a lot about the relationships that Mr. Hervey has had throughout his wonderful career that continues. I don't see you as a person who's ever going to retire. So
I don't think that's never crossed my mind, at least not yet.
That's good. You are officially a part of our Austin and Boulder based NR club, which is never retiring. Okay.
Oh, great. I'm happy to join you guys. Thank you.
You bet. Mr. Hervey, it was an honor to honor you today, and I hope that people buy your book, The Fame Game. And thank you so much for taking time to be on our show today.
Thank you, Rick. I appreciate it. I enjoyed talking to you very much. Great questions.
Well, thank you, sir. Great questions come with great guests. How about that?
Okay. We'll share that. Great collaboration today.
Great collaboration. Thank you, folks, for joining us. And as we say, you know, on your busy, fast-paced life toward success or whatever you're chasing, stop and do something significant this week. Have a good one.
All right. Take care.
I am so glad that we met Serban Marasini of Edward Jones Financial Advisors. Serban has been there for all of our life moments, always centered on us and where we want to go. He was instrumental in helping us live around the world, building our media company, and nurturing us as a true partner for the next stage of our lives. You know, there are 19,000 financial advisors serving over 7 million clients. But Serban treats us like we are the only one, and the one that really matters. If you want to contact Serban, call him today at 303-494-2310. Again, the number is 303-494-2310. You know that life is for the living. Why not partner for all of it with Edward Jones?